Welcome to All Things Collected, brought to you by the Journal of Antiques and Collectibles, a special interest magazine for dealers, collectors, and enthusiasts of antique collectibles. I'm your host, Erica Lohm. Today's episode is dedicated to the history, art, and collectibility of needlework, everything from quilting to embroidery, knitting, and sewing. In this episode, we share the story of the 1933 Sears National Quilt Contest and take you through the Robert and Helen Cargo collection of African-American quilts at the International Quilt Museum in Lincoln, Nebraska. But before we get started, let's catch up on what's happening in the world of antiques and collectibles. The New York Historical Society has announced an extraordinary promise gift from philanthropists and art collectors Ellie and Sarah Hirschfield. The couple's Scenes from New York City collection comprises 130 artworks dating from the mid-19th through the 21st centuries, including works by, among others, Isabel Bishop, Marc Chagall, David Hockney, Edward Hopper, Yvonne Jacquet, Jacob Lawrence, Louise Nelvelson, George O'Keefe, Norman Rockwell, and Andy Warhol. The collection of paintings, works on paper in various media, and sculpture includes 113 works by 82 artists not currently represented in New York Historical's collection. The works are united by a thematic thread that celebrates New York City, its buildings, bridges, parks, landmarks, and people. A major exhibition with an accompanying publication is planned for fall 2021, and a dedicated space, the Ellie and Sarah Hirschfield Gallery Scenes of New York City, will showcase a rotation of works from the collection. A statue of President Theodore Roosevelt in front of the American Museum of Natural History in New York City will be removed, according to a statement from New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio's office on June 21st. The statue, which features the nation's 26th president on a horse with a Native American man standing on one side and an African man standing on the other, was commissioned in 1925 and made its debut in 1940, where it welcomes guests through the Central Park West entrance of the museum. While it was intended to celebrate Roosevelt as a devoted naturalist and author of works on natural history, the statue also communicates a racial hierarchy that the museum and members of the public have long found disturbing, a press release on the museum's website said. Quote, "The American Museum of Natural History has asked to remove the Theodore Roosevelt statue because it explicitly depicts Black and Indigenous people as subjugated and racially inferior," de Blasio's office said in a statement to CNN. "The city supports the museum's request. It is the right decision and the right time to remove this problematic statue." The announcement comes as several states grapple with how to handle removals of Confederate monuments and other controversial statues. A very extensive collection of 203 autographed letters, documents, and signatures signed by 16 chief and 93 associate justices from 1789 to 2017 went up for sale at Hinman's June 23rd Fine Books and Manuscripts auction and brought in $25,000. Complete from John Jay through William Rehnquist, this is the most complete collection of justices' signatures to ever be offered at auction. The collection contains excellent examples of even the rarest justices, and from three justices nominated but never confirmed, as well as examples from nine justices from the Rehnquist and Roberts courts. For more marketplace news, sign up at journalofantiques.com to receive our free post-press update delivered twice a month to your inbox. And we're back and looking at the history, art, and collectibility of needlework with our publisher, Maxine Carter Lohm.
In 18th century America, a girl was expected to grow up, get married, have children, and take care of a home. Because of the limits of her sphere, a girl received a very different education from that available to a boy. In fact, to receive any education at all before the advent of widespread public education, a boy or a girl had to be born into the middle or upper classes and have parents who valued education enough to pay for it. In the first half of the 19th century, boys in the middle and upper classes were taught traditional academic subjects, while girls were schooled in what was considered female accomplishments, music, watercolor painting, comportment, manners, and sewing. For these girls, sewing, or fancy work, was a required skill and refined art, whereas for girls in the lower classes, knowing how to sew was a basic necessity and a way to gain employment. This made sewing the great leveler. It was a skill shared, although to varying degrees, by women of all economic backgrounds and social classes. Most young girls learn their needle and thread work at home at a very young age, most probably from their mother or grandmother, and by age 5 or 6 might have completed a marking sampler to showcase their work and talent. It is called a marking sampler because the knowledge gained enabled a needleworker to mark such things as clothing and household linens. In addition to improving a student's embroidery techniques, these samplers, which often contain letters of the alphabet and numerals, were also a way to teach young girls how to form words essential for reading and therefore necessary to the management and operation of her future household. For more on the history and market for samplers, turn to Melody Amsel Ariel's article on page 26 in this month's issue. Depending on a girl's social class and skill set, sewing was a chore, hobby, or a refined skill. But by the mid-19th century, technology in the form of Isaac Singer's sewing machine eased the burden for women all over the country, especially for those who depended on sewing for their livelihood and to clothe their families. From 1846 to 1896, the sewing machine went from a circus attraction. With the mechanization of the sewing process, needlework became a refined skill in the form of decorative showpieces, high-end fashion, and handiwork hobbies such as quilting, embroidery, and knitting, while the basic skill of sewing was relegated to repair work and alterations as more and more of the family's clothing was purchased ready-made. The life skills education that young girls once received at home at the feet of their mothers and grandmothers was institutionally turned over to the public school system in the 1900s when home economics was added to the curriculum for young girls, while the boys went to shop class. The home economics curriculum was designed to teach young girls to be good housekeepers and wives and provide them with life skills deemed appropriate for the times, cooking, sewing, baking, cleaning, and an understanding of household management. It also was designed to help young girls gain useful employment and live independently as a 20th century industrialized nation welcomed young women into the workforce for office, retail, and factory work. This gender-based option remained a requirement and the norm in public education until the 1960s and the feminist movement. Today, these basic skills are part of the curriculum of classes more aptly labeled family studies, food and nutrition, health and safety, family and consumer science, and household science. While the basics of sewing were provided through the public education system through the first half of the 20th century, such needlework skills as embroidery, knitting, and quilting as an intergenerational hobby, a form of artistic expression, and a craft continued on a path of its own as a pastime, trade, skill, and cultural art form. However, by the 1950s, access to skilled educators of traditional execution was limited to a new generation of crafters and longtime needleworkers looking to learn a new skill. And then along came Erica Wilson, the Julia Child of embroidery. If you have not heard of Erica Wilson before, you soon will, as Winterthur Museum gears up for a new book and exhibition on her life and work. You can start your education here on page 23 in this month's issue with Linda Eaton's article, Erica Wilson, Sharing Joy Through Embroidery. While the importance and perception of all women learning at least basic sewing skills have changed over time, there is no doubt that needlework as an art form and craft continues to attract new crafters, fans, and new collectors of the hobby. In this issue, we look back on 2 centuries of needlework and the stories, makers, and technology behind collectible objects made of needle and thread. Next, Paula Sherwin shares an interesting story about the Sears National Quilt Contest.
The Sears National Quilt Contest, a story from the Quilt Index by Mary Kay Waldvogel. The Sears National Quilt Contest, organized by the Sears Roebuck & Company in connection with the Chicago World's Fair, known officially as the Century of Progress Exposition, was announced in the January 1933 Sears Roebuck catalog. They offered $7,500 in prizes, including a grand prize of $1,000. Why is this contest so important to quilt historians? Because more than 24,000 quilts were entered, making the Sears contest the largest quilt contest in history. Nearly 80 years later, the record still stands. By offering such a large prize when the nation's economy wasn't good, the company sent in motion a huge amount of quilting. People who had never quilted before decided to give it a try. Husbands and boyfriends helped make the quilts as well. Adept quilters did their very best work. Local Sears stores not only sold fabric, supplies, and patterns, they displayed the finished quilts. The effects of the contest were long-lasting. The contest instructions were simple. Enter a quilt of your own making, which had not been exhibited before. Sears did not want an exhibit of antique quilts. Sears offered quilting advice at their stores. The contest was advertised through the Sears catalog, on a WLS radio broadcast, and in local newspapers that displayed Sears advertising throughout the nation. At the time, Sears Roebuck was headquartered in Chicago and owned the WLS radio station. Sears staff based in Chicago were Sue Roberts, the contest organizer, whose signature appeared on all the letters sent by Sears to the quilt entrants, and Mae Wilford, who served as the quilt advisor in the Chicago area Sears stores. The quilters had just 4 months to finish their quilts. The deadline was May 15 for the first round of judging. The top three winners at the local round were sent to one of the 10 regional mail order houses for another round of judging. Regional mail order houses included Boston, Philadelphia, Atlanta, Minneapolis, Chicago, Memphis, Kansas City, Dallas, Seattle, and Los Angeles. At the Atlanta regional round, for example, there were 1,100 quilts. Only 3 from each region were sent to the national round. And of those 30, the judges chose the top 3 and an honorable mention. Presumably, all 30 quilts were exhibited during the fair that first summer in 1933. Unfortunately, no photographs exist of the quilts on display that summer. There were some publicity photos of the judges with the top 3 quilts sent to local newspapers. For example, the Lexington, Kentucky newspaper carried an interview with Margaret Caden, whose traditional quilt, Star of the Bluegrass, had been awarded the $1,000 grand prize. Although traditional pieced and applique quilt designs won the top prizes, Sears invited originally designed quilts that would depict the spirit of the century of progress. They even offered an incentive of $200 if an original design won the grand prize. It is interesting to see how quilters handled this challenge. Some simply embroidered the words, "A Century of Progress," across the upper border of a quilt made from a standard pattern. Others spent many hours in the library researching inventions and technological advances to include in their quilt designs. Chicago area quilters who took up the challenge often incorporated aspects of the World's Fair itself. The 1933 Chicago World's Fair commemorated the 100th birthday of the founding of Chicago. The dates 1833 and 1933 were embroidered, appliqued, and quilted into the entries. Some included the story of Fort Dearborn and the Chicago Fire. It is important to note that the construction of the fair occurred during the Great Depression. The buildings at the fair went up slowly. The replica of Fort Dearborn was erected early and people were encouraged to visit. Promotional brochures included line drawings of the buildings that were planned. The Sears Pavilion was on the front of the contest brochure, and it figured prominently on a number of quilts entered into the contest. Unfortunately, only 2 commemorative quilts reached the final round, and neither won the grand prize, so the $200 bonus was not awarded. Chicago quilt makers grumbled that their local and regional judges had not treated the Century of Progress quilts fairly. Ida Stowe sent a protest letter to Sears, but received only a curt reply. However, in the summer of 1934, the fair's managers decided to open the fair for a second season. Sears had already returned the 30 quilts. Sue Roberts invited the top 10 winners to send their quilts back to the Sears Pavilion. They also invited Chicago quilters who had made commemorative quilts to display their quilts. Sears Photograph Prize quilts, as well as the commemorative quilts, and Ida Stowe's quilt was front and center. The Sears Quilt Contest search began when Barbara Brackman was living in Chicago in the late 1970s. She knew about the Sears Quilt Contest and visited the headquarters to ask about contest archives. They had a few photos and a catalog page listing the top 30 winners. Barbara decided to try to find all the 30 quilters to document their stories and their quilts, reaching out to local newspapers, mentioning the search during workshops and lectures, and writing for a variety of quilters' publications. As the word spread, she began to get referrals. Mary Kay met Barbara Brackman at the Southern Quilt Symposium in Chattanooga in 1984. A Sears contest quilt showed up at the Quilts of Tennessee Survey Day. In Mary Kay's words, "In 1990, when I wrote Soft Covers for Hard Times, Quilt Making and the Great Depression, I included a chapter on the Sears contest as it played out in the South. Following the publication of Soft Covers, Brackman proposed we write a book together, solely devoted to the Sears contest. We pored through the quilt stories that had been referred to Brackman and chose several for the book. We also renewed our quest for new discoveries." When the book Patchwork Souvenirs of the 1933 World's Fair was published in 1993, the list of found quilts totaled 95. An exhibit of the quilts in the book, organized by the Knoxville Museum of Art and the Smith Kramer Fine Arts, traveled to 10 museums. With publicity about the book and exhibit, more contest quilts appeared. When the exhibit tour ended in 1996, more than 150 quilts had been found. Both of us continued to write and lecture about the contest. I even acquired two of my own contest quilts, one via an online auction that still had the entry tag attached, and one commemorative quilt I named A Bird's Eye View of the World's Fair Site, also with a tag attached. The Sears Contest Project for the Quilt Index provided an opportunity to share what we had found. For this project, only the most fully authenticated contest quilts were selected for this online repository. Quilts with good color photographs received preference, but not all the important quilts had color photos. All the final round quilters' names are included, even though some quilts are still missing. Fortunately, quilts were often photographed for local newspapers. When available, we have used those photos. We also found a written eyewitness account of the quilts on display at the Sears Pavilion in 1933. Dr. William Rush Dunton, Jr., visited the display and recorded descriptions that often included the quilt name, pattern, colors, and quilting designs. As of June 2011, 235 quilts were in the database kept by Mary Kay. Is it possible you have a Sears contest quilt? Over 24,000 quilts were entered into the contest, and we have only found information on a small percentage. We have winners' names that were printed in newspapers, and of course the top 30 winners' names and hometowns which were published in the Sears catalog. The list of known entrants and prize winners is listed on the Quilt Index. If you have a quilt that has a contest entry tag sewn to it, or it has a ribbon attached, it is the best proof that the quilt was actually entered in the contest. Ribbons are a strong evidence that a quilt maker won a prize in the contest, though not necessarily with a particular quilt. If a quilt has World's Fair imagery, the Sears Pavilion, or the dates 1833 to 1933 applique to it, it was likely made for the contest. Mary Kay Walvogel is the author of Patchwork Souvenirs of the 1933 World's Fair with Barbara Brackman. She also has many other titles on quilting and many studies that she and fellow experts in the field have conducted on the topic. Walvogel is a 2009 inductee to the Quilters Hall of Fame. Mary Kay's lectures and workshops are her true gifts to the people in the quilt world. The Quilt Index is an open-access, digital repository of thousands of images, stories, and information about quilts and their quilt makers drawn from hundreds of public and private collections around the world. User tools such as search and compare facilitate inquiry and education. The Quilt Index is a digital humanities research and education project of Michigan State University's Matrix, the Center for Digital Humanities and Social Sciences.
And we're back, sharing the latest gavel down prices on some of the most interesting items coming to market. Annie Oakley's Little Miss Sure Shot rifle, engraved with her name and the town where she resided, gaveled for $528,900 at a sale of Extraordinary Sporting and Collector Firearms held May 22nd through 29th by Morphy Auctions in Denver, PA. Meanwhile, a color satin finish signed photo of the late actor Heath Ledger in his Oscar-winning role as the Joker from the 2008 film The Dark Knight sold for $10,236 in an online auction held May 13th by RR Auction based in Boston. An Andy Warhol Mick Jagger complete portfolio of 10 screen prints sold for $817,000 at an auction held June 14th by Clar's Auction Gallery in Oakland, California. And an exceedingly rare Pokemon Super Secret Battle No. 1 Trainer Trainer Promo Hologram Trading Card, one of seven known to exist, sold for a record-breaking $90,000 on Thursday, July 9th at a public auction of comic and comic art held by Heritage Auctions. Collectors consider the Trainer promo card possibly the most sought-after card, and arguably one of the rarest cards in the entire Pokemon trading card game. Equated to one of Willy Wonka's golden tickets, the holographic Trainer card allowed the owner preferential entrance to a secret game tournament, hence the card's name, Super Secret Battle. The finals took place on August 22, 1999 in Tokyo. The 1999 card is graded a Gem Mint 10, meaning the rarity is in the finest condition of any such card offered at auction. To view the entire August Needle and Thread issue, with additional articles on the history of friendship quilts, samplers, and memorial quilts, visit journalofantiques.com, where you will also find past issues, other articles of interest, a calendar of upcoming shows and auctions, antique shops to visit around the country, and the value of what is recently sold at auction. While there, you can also subscribe to receive our publication in print and sign up to receive our bi-monthly free e-newsletter, Post Press Update. The Journal of Antiques and Collectibles is published by Weathervane Enterprises, Inc. Thank you for listening to All Things Collected. Join us next month where we explore the collectible topic of science and technology.